From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In Spain, world leaders are gathering for COP25. This is the conference of the parties, those signed on to the UN Treaty to Combat Climate Change. The 2015 Paris Agreement was forged at COP21. President Trump is withdrawing the U.S. from that agreement, and yesterday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres pulled no punches. He said the largest emitters aren't pulling their weight, and the point of no return is no longer over the horizon. Matt McGraw is the environment correspondent for the BBC. He's in Madrid. And Matt, we should say that the Democrat Nancy Pelosi is leading a delegation of Democratic lawmakers to Madrid. But this is a two-week meeting. It launches a year-long effort. What's the goal?
Well, the main goal, Robin, is to try and advance the promises that were made under the Paris Climate Agreement 5 years ago and to try and get all the major countries and the smaller ones as well to commit to new plans that will be put in place by the end of next year when this meeting moves on to Glasgow in the UK. And that is the whole point of all that, is to try and ensure that the global temperatures don't rise by more than 1.5 degrees, which we're heading towards now by 2030, right, if those new, stronger plans don't come into place.
And he said in his talks to reporters yesterday, this is Guterres, we're here to find answers for Article 6, not to find excuses. What does that mean?
Yeah, Article 6 has been a bit of a bugbear on this process for the last year or so. It's about how you use carbon markets, how you use markets to allow countries to trade some of their emissions to other countries. So there's a lot of countries with vested interest in this, the Russia, Brazil, countries who've done well in the past out of selling these types of emissions want to continue to be able to use these type of credits, as they're called.
Right.
Lots of other countries say, look, you ruin the whole process if you try and keep the value in these things. So there's a big dispute over that, and it's gone on for a year now, and it might roll on through Madrid as well.
Yeah, this is apparently one of the most contentious things that's going to be hammered out over the next couple of weeks. And what about the big emitters, China, the U.S.? The U.S. in particular, with, you know, we have a president who has said he doesn't believe in even the theory behind all of this, that climate crisis is man-made, and he's rolling back a lot of the Obama-era environmental protections and regulations. What's the sense there? How does that feel there?
Yeah, I mean, obviously this might be the last year in which the U.S. negotiating team takes part in this process. And so I think for a couple of years now, people have been quite bullish about it. They've been saying, oh, well, we'll be able to cope. We'll be able to get on. The world isn't just revolve around the United States. But I think this year and right here this week, I think there's a feeling that the big polluters, the United States, China, Brazil, and many others who have set their faces almost against climate change, that their input is desperately needed if the world is really going to turn this corner, bend the curve on this 1.5 degrees. And I think the message from Nancy Pelosi, who's been speaking here, to say that the United States is still in is very welcome news for the conference. But the reality is that in a year's time, one day after the next presidential election, the U.S. is officially out, unless perhaps there's a change of occupant in the White House.
And we should say the Trump administration is being represented by Marsha Bernicat, who's principal deputy assistant secretary of state for oceans and international environmental and scientific affairs. Matt, tell us also about the language that we heard from Guterres, you know, trying to get across that we're almost at endgame here on this issue, talking about we have to have the political will to shift taxation from income to carbon, tax pollution instead of people. You know, what's the sense there of how much they're going to be able to accomplish, given that we've had report after report, and it starts to feel like wallpaper?
Yeah, that's certainly true. I think Secretary General Guterres is trying to outline is perhaps the most radical set of proposals any UN Secretary General has ever come up with to try and deal with the problem of climate change. And I think it perhaps reflects his sense of exasperation. Frustration, maybe he's feeling some sense of impotence, but he seems determined to drive home his point that the world is not doing enough, the ambition is not high enough, and the time is incredibly short.
Well, and there are young people making that case. I just want to ask you briefly about teenage climate activist Greta Thunberg of Sweden. She sailed across the ocean to the U.S. thinking that she was going to walk to Chile, where this climate conference was supposed to be held. It was moved to Spain because of unrest in Chile. But now she had to hop back on her catamaran and sail back across to try to get to Spain. Is she expected to make it?
Yes, providing she can find her sea legs when she gets off the boat and in Lisbon. She's due to get in there tomorrow, we think, and she's likely to be here at this conference before the end of the week. She's slated to give a talk to the Assembly. It's bizarre to think that a little-known schoolgirl a year ago, it may now well be the biggest draw at this event this week and perhaps next.
Matt McGraw, environment correspondent for the BBC in Madrid. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Today, Montana Governor Steve Bullock dropped out of the race for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination. Former Pennsylvania Congressman Joe Sestak did the same yesterday, which means 16 Democrats are still running for president. Joining us now is NPR political reporter Juana Summers. Hi, Juana.
Hey, Jeremy.
So the next debate for the Democrats is December 19th, and so far only six have qualified: Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, Kamala Harris, and Amy Klobuchar. Do you expect more candidates to drop out of the race before then?
Yeah, that's certainly something that we're watching for. The DNC has put in place far stricter rules for that sixth debate, and there's only, give or take, 2 weeks until that qualifying deadline. While not being able to make the stage doesn't automatically mean a candidate will drop out of the race, something that we've seen happen with other candidates like Julian Castro, for example, who's still in it, even though he wasn't on stage. It does deprive the candidates of a really important platform to introduce themselves to new support, would-be supporters, a way to raise more money. So that can have a winnowing effect. And also, frankly, the calendar is just getting really late. They're about only a couple months until voting begins. So financial realities could really start to set in for some of these candidates that haven't been able to break into the top tier and who don't see a viable path for their candidacy at this point.
Now, one candidate who's been kind of in the top tier all along is Joe Biden, the former vice president. He is still leading in the national polls. He's on the third day now of a week-long no malarkey bus tour in Iowa. By the way, the definition of malarkey is written on the side of his bus for people who don't know what that means. Early on in his campaign, he was saying he didn't need to win Iowa. What's the latest thinking?
So I'm heading on that bus tour later this week, and the former vice president is going through 18 counties in the state. That's clearly a huge investment of his time at this critical moment in the race. We heard the former vice president kind of talk about why he's doing this now over the weekend. He made the case that this is the time to peak in Iowa. 2 months before voters start to really tune in, before those first votes are cast, this is when he wants to be making that investment and spending a lot of time there. And make no mistake, this is also coming as South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg is performing quite well in the state. And many say that he and the former vice president are competing for that same lane of centrist voters for primary support.
Well, let's talk about Pete Buttigieg. In an ad that is now airing in Iowa, he is criticizing his rivals for their free college tuition plans. He says they would benefit a lot of wealthier students. Here it is.
I only want to make promises that we can keep. Look, what I'm proposing is plenty bold. I mean, these are big ideas. We can gather the majority to drive those big ideas through without turning off half the country before we even get into office.
And how concerned are the other candidates about Buttigieg's surge in the polls, and what are they planning to do about it?
I think there is quite a bit of concern. And if you listen to the way he talks in that ad, he doesn't say the names, say Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, mm-hmm. but you hear him clapping back to folks who have bold plans and big ideas and saying, hey, look, I'm a guy who has those kind of big plans too. Now, when I talk to rival campaigns about Pete Buttigieg and how he's performing, one of the biggest things they point to is the fact that while he's rising in the polls in places like Iowa and New Hampshire and polls quite well in other places with older white Americans, he has almost no backing from black voters who are incredibly important to a Democratic path to the nomination. And he lags behind some of his rivals like Warren and Sanders when it comes to younger voters. So that's why you see him this week focusing on southern states like North Carolina and South Carolina, looking for new ways to connect with black voters, aiming at that weakness that a number of his rivals have pointed out.
Do you think that that weakness among black voters is unique to Buttigieg, or are a lot of candidates kind of in the same level of polling when it comes to African-American voters?
That's a great point. I actually don't think it's unique to him. We've seen former Vice President Biden have sort of a strong firewall with black voters, particularly a commanding advantage in South Carolina. But other candidates out there, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren also does not poll particularly well among black voters. We've seen Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders certainly improve his standing from his first presidential campaign. But it would be unfair to say that Pete Buttigieg is the only candidate who is lacking with that key demographic in the Democratic electorate.
Okay, I want to finally ask you about the two new entrants into the race and how they're doing at this point. That would be former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg and former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick.
Yeah, so Michael Bloomberg has obviously jolted this race just by the sheer amount of money he's been able to spend really dominating the television airwaves. Was joking with some friends who are home over the holidays that one of the only political candidates' ads they saw on television over the Thanksgiving holiday was Michael Bloomberg. He's focusing his spending in some of the early Super Tuesday states that he is targeting, and those are places that some of the other candidates aren't spending as much time or money in yet as they focus on those first four contests in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada. As for Deval Patrick, he is starting to staff up. His campaign has recently announced some new hires in New Hampshire and South Carolina, two states he sees as key to his strategy. But he's entering the race a lot later than many other candidates, risking the possibility of not being able to get into those debates just because he doesn't have enough time or a poor showing in these states that he's targeting.
That is NPR political reporter Juana Summers. Juana, thank you and great to have you back at NPR.
Thanks so much.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here Now helps you make sense of the world. And when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations. Thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news. Who wouldn't want to be Trisha Yearwood? She's a country singing legend. There was great excitement earlier this year when she released Every Girl, her first solo country album in 12 years. Here's a little of the lead single, Every Girl in This Town.
We dance and we laugh till we all fall. Off the ground, like every girl in this town.
Oh, my favorite lyric. Every girl in this town is somebody's daughter. Trisha Yearwood also has a hit Food Network show, Trisha's Southern Kitchen, now in its 15th season. Fans just love her recipes, but also her, you know, breezy style.
I'm going to get to work on a smoky aioli to go on top of these potatoes, which is super yummy. So aioli is basically fancy mayonnaise. I had to look it up because I was like, I'm not really sure what goes in it.
And did we mention that she's married to some guy, Garth Brooks, I think? Only the best-selling solo artist of all time. This week, Trisha Yearwood is hosting the CMA Country Christmas Show, taking over from her friend and mentor, Reba McEntire. And she's found a few minutes to talk with us. Trisha Yearwood, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
What do you think it is, you know, of your life experiences that have fused together and created the Trisha Yearwood, who is this artist and also, you know, an artisan in the kitchen?
You know what? I don't know, really, but I think what it is, not to quote my own album, but I really am sort of every girl. I feel like I kind of represent most of us. Most of us who cook are not chefs. We learned how to cook from our mom or dad. And I came from a very small town and wanted to be a singer since I was 5 years old, but didn't know anybody who was doing this. So I kind of feel like I'm the one who gets to do it all for all of us. And I'm as surprised and excited about it still, 28 years after getting started, that I get to do it. And I really am. And I think that's probably why people relate, because they feel like I could be in the kitchen with her. It wouldn't be weird. And if I dropped an egg on the floor, she wouldn't think that was a bad thing, because she does that too. It's just real.
Yeah. Well, the girl with the wind in her hair up in the Ferris wheel when the fair comes to town, or on the porch under the yellow light crying when a date goes wrong on Friday night. I mean, it's just a beautiful song. Let's listen to another one. This is Bible and a 44. Let's listen.
He had a southern drawl like a red-bone hound, and every word he said was my favorite sound. He'd be the last one off if the ship went down. The kind of man it feels good to be around. The kind of man it feels good to be around. He had hair as white as a cotton field, and he could spin you a story like a wagon wheel. All heart and soul and made of steel.
Song written by Ashley McBride, and she wrote it about her dad, but we understand it was a song for your dad as well.
Yeah.
How so?
Well, my dad was that Southern drawl line really got me. I actually asked Ashley if I could change the... Her lyrics said every song he sang was my favorite sound, and I asked if I could say every word he said, because my dad had this Southern accent that was almost like Foghorn Leghorn. You know, he kind of had this, like, I say. And so he's gone now, but his voice is what I remember so much about him. It's still in my head. And I think the power of a great songwriter is to be able to write something that is so personal to them. I mean, the song is about Ashley's dad, and for it to feel so personal to me. And this is one of those songs that when I sing it live, it really does connect with especially girls and their daddies.
Yeah, all heart and soul and made of steel. When I was listening to that lyric about your dad, I was thinking, Garth Brooks, you had a hard act to follow. You know, because everybody's dad, you know, if you have that relationship, that's your first love. Would you say Garth Brooks is anything like your dad?
Absolutely. I mean, I do think that. I think that's one of the things about him that I love so much is that my dad was my biggest fan. He was a huge fan of country music. He loved and got to see a lot of my career. But I always felt like at the end of the day, I was daddy's little girl, and I felt like he had my back, and he was there to take care of me. And Garth has always said, I don't want to take care of you because you need to be taken care of. You're independent. You do your own thing. But I want you to know that I'm here if you need me. And he is, you know, and one of the last things that my dad got to see was Garth and I get engaged. And my dad was like, okay, I feel good now. Like, I feel like, I honestly feel like my dad thought, okay, Garth's got this.
Oh, I feel a song coming on too. I mean, one that describes that. But did your dad have sparks that flew from his fingertips? Let's listen to a little bit of a song that you have said is maybe something of a metaphor for your relationship with Garth Brooks. It's called The Matador. Let's listen.
I threw a rose to the matador, not sure who I was cheering for. My aim was true, my heart was full. I love the fighter and the bull. I love like only a woman can, a very complicated man. I bound his wounds, I heard his cries. I gave him truth, I told him lies.
So we're picturing the matador, and again, you go on to say, you know, his rage is made of many things, faithless women, wedding rings, snakes and snails and alcohol, but sparks fly from his fingertips, words like birds fly from his lips. What an image of a Garth Brooks on stage. Tell us more about what is that?
You know, I don't know that he agrees with me on this. I've always been very dramatic, even as a little girl. Before I even had any heartbreak, I just would sing these, you know, songs that were so about heartbreak. The Matador was written by Gretchen Peters, who's an incredibly talented singer-songwriter. Right. And for me, you know, what I felt was, there is something about, I mean, he loves me more than anything in the world. He loves his children more than anything in the world. But there's something about being in the musical arena,
the ring,
and getting to do what you do,
yeah,
that is unmatched and is something that no one can really share with you in that moment. I think he and I being in the same industry come as close as two people can to sharing that,
right,
feeling. But there is something about watching him in the ring doing what he does, and sparks do fly from his fingertips. I mean, it is something to behold.
But, you know, words like birds fly from your lips, too. What's that? I mean, do you talk about that? Do you each talk about something that nobody else? I mean, I don't even know what it would be.
I think one of the things, I mean, everybody talks about two celebrities being married and how hard that is. And it is, the only thing hard about it is because we both are really busy. But I think we can, the advantage to being married to someone who does what you do is to be able to talk about what you do for a living, and also to have kind of an unspoken understanding of the drive and the need and the desire that feeds your soul of why you really feel not even like you made a choice to do this, but that you're called to do it. And so you've got to give each other the freedom to be that, because that's who makes him who he is, and that's who makes me who I am.
Yeah. And that's hard for some people maybe not familiar with that center stage to accept it in somebody else. Yeah. Plus, you have to put up with his breakfast bowl, which I understand is cheese and garlic tortellini.
It is. And you know what I got to say? I've been working on the cooking show, and I've been releasing this album, and I have been just really busy this fall. And I haven't cooked at home very much. And I told him yesterday or a couple of days ago at home, I said, the last couple of times that I have walked into this kitchen and it has smelled amazing, you have been cooking, not me. And he is really good. And he's just that guy. And the breakfast bowl is everything you would want to ever eat for breakfast that you could imagine in a bowl, plus tortellini. And you really need to eat that, and then, like, you don't have to eat for a week because it's like it's a lot. It's a lot.
Right. You have it in one of your cookbooks. You want to hear some more music, including you did an album of songs that Frank Sinatra owned. Let's just listen to a little of Come Fly With Me.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly away.
Wow, I mean, Trisha Yearwood, are you at the point where you're like, what else can my voice do? I mean, is it fun for you to try something like that and see how far, where you could go?
Yes, so much fun. You know, it's like getting out of your comfort zone a little bit is scary, but also usually the most rewarding thing. And I had always loved this music. My mom was a third grade school teacher, and we would get home in the afternoons. And sometimes before she'd have that little amount of time before she'd have to start dinner, we would watch some of these old movies and musicals and listen to these songs. And I always felt like, man, I love this music. I feel like I wish I would have been born during that time in the 30s and 40s to do this music. And so I did the record, and I went to Capitol Records where Frank recorded. I used his microphone. Some of the guys in the band had played with Frank. And I was terrified. Mm-hmm. You know, I walked in the first day and I thought they're going to go, oh, this little country girl is here. This is going to be so terrible. And then when I sang the first song and they were like, oh, okay. Then we had the best time. So I'm so glad I got a chance to do it.
Yeah. Love to hear other things that you experiment with. But meanwhile, the album Every Girl is just great. And we want to hear a little of one of the other songs. This is called Love You Anyway. It's with Don Henley in part. By the way, do you think The End of the Innocents was maybe one of the most perfect albums ever made?
Perfect. Okay. I love him so much. Yep. Yes. We agree.
Yeah. Okay. We agree. And he's backing you up, Trisha Yearwood. Let's listen.
Tear this heart right out of me. Lock it up and lose the key. Curse my name when you kneel to pray. I'm gonna love you. Anyway.
Sublime. That's country music star Trisha Yearwood on her latest album, Every Girl. She also hosts Trisha's Southern Kitchen on the Food Network, and she'll be hosting the CMA Country Christmas Show tomorrow night. Trisha, I don't know how you found the time to talk to us, but thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today is Cyber Monday, as if I had to tell you that, and we have reached the point where today is a bigger day for many retailers than Black Friday is. That used to be the biggest shopping day of the year. For more, let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
You have any money left after the shopping this morning?
It was a little rough for me in between radio hits this morning.
Okay. Well, we're already getting some early retail numbers in. According to Adobe Analytics, online sales increased by about 20% from last year, while shopping at brick-and-mortar stores fell by about 6%. Is Cyber Monday even a distinct thing anymore? Is it kind of like Cyber Week or Black November, December? What are we looking at here?
We know that some large retailers started rolling out the deals as of November 1st. So imagine this. Your goblins come down, your wreaths go up, and they've gotten very smart. There is a distinct part of each of these days, mostly because all of these large retailers have tons of data, and they are dribbling out the deals based on the day. So we know that today, Cyber Monday, you'll probably see the steepest discount on a television. However, an appliance may have been a better bet on Friday. Mm. All these things said, it is becoming a massive, long holiday season for those who are paying attention.
I noticed something interesting, which is that on Thanksgiving Day, almost half of the online sales were done on mobile devices, which just made me imagine some people sitting at the Thanksgiving table looking down at their phones and, oh, I'll buy that.
Yes, it probably may have been cheaper than their therapy session that follows. But yes, I mean, listen, we're shopping everywhere. So desktop, smartphone, tablet, and it's all being tracked. Now, some of us are actually surfing on our smartphones, but purchasing on our desktops. And I think that is really kind of this interesting trend that we are seeing. And that we want to shop where and when we want to shop. And retailers are actually changing their business models accordingly. They call it multi-channel marketing, essentially just making sure they are where we are. And that's why you will see some of these things that pop up in your face in places where you never realized.
I guess there's no concern right now about a recession based on the fact that people are still spending so much money.
You know, if there is a concern, and certainly surveys will tell us that people are having some recessionary fears bubbling up, but I think two factors that are really important. Number one, we do still have a good jobs market. We're going to get another Labor Department report out this Friday. There are going to be more people employed. They're going to see wages rise faster than the rate of inflation. So that makes people feel confident. You know, we are likely to get something like $9.4 billion in sales this day, this Cyber Monday, and that would be an almost 19% increase from last year.
So, Jill, with all of this online shopping, let's not forget about all of those packages that have to be used to send things out and a lot of cardboard being used. We remember that China isn't taking our recycling materials anymore. Where's all the cardboard going?
That's a great question. You know, the cities across the United States are talking about something called the Amazon effect. And we are seeing cities trying to scramble to figure out where to send their cardboard and their plastics. And the municipalities say there just isn't enough domestic ability to supply paper mills to meet the demand. Mm-hmm. And so, unfortunately, I think this is what's really piling up in a lot of our landfills is stuff that hasn't even been recycled that could be.
That's Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thank you.
Thank you.
Freezing rain and snow in the Northeast have blocked millions of people from returning home after the Thanksgiving holiday. Airlines canceled or delayed thousands of flights in anticipation of the weather. But while humans can make plans to stay safe during a storm, our animal friends aren't always so lucky. For more, we're joined by Steve Ranella. He's an outdoorsman and writer and the host of the Netflix show Meat Eater. Steve, welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
So when a storm system is headed towards a place, we humans have very sophisticated weather forecasting that often gives us enough time to make preparations, maybe evacuate. What kind of capacity do animals have to sense and avoid storms?
Man, you know, it really depends, it seems, on the kind of animal. Definitely fish have a lot of sensitivity to barometric pressure. And there were some studies that they worked on in Florida where they happened to have some sharks that were wearing the shark equivalent of a radio collar, right? Mm-hmm. And ahead of Hurricane Gabriel in 2001, they had 14 black-tipped sharks that were wearing transmitters. And all 14 of them moved out to deep water off the coast of Florida ahead of Hurricane Gabriel. But then there's other species that just seems to not really care. When Hurricane Irma came through in 2017, and this hurricane happened to pass 13 miles away from a deer study area, 135 mile an hour winds, 12 inches of rain, right? And they had 60 deer wearing GPS collars. Not only were none of those deer killed, none of those deer changed their tune. They acted on that day, the day that it made landfall, they acted just like they always act. And they just went about their business like nothing was going on.
Okay, so but for the animals that do notice that something is about to happen, apparently, do you think that it is about barometric pressure and that pressure dropping and they know that they've got to move?
That's the idea that most people have. And it seems like fish are especially in tune to it. You know, the fish have a thing called a lateral line where they can, where they sense pressure and can detect pressure changes. That could be movement in the water near them, but other things as well. And some fish seem to become active and like to feed when there is a high pressure system. Other fish, a high pressure system might send them off. But it seems to be that it would be barometric pressure. You know, that's usually something that we, with our instrumentation, that we can monitor and notice that we have a change in barometric pressure ahead of a storm. If it's not that, it's something that we don't yet understand about what it could be that they're picking up on and looking at. There were some wild horse herds in the Outer Banks in North Carolina, and people were watching these horses and very worried about what would happen when Hurricane Dorian came through. And people noticed that ahead of the storm, it seemed that the horses were moving to higher ground and gathering up in clusters, because one of the things the horses will do is they'll gather up in groups, maybe to stabilize one another and they'll face with their rumps into the wind. And they were seeing this activity on the Outer Banks with some of these wild horse herds ahead of the storm. But in one case on Cedar Island, even that didn't save these horses, because there's a herd of 49 horses on Cedar Island. 28 of them were killed by a storm surge from Dorian. So even though they seemed to detect that it was coming and took the right steps, it wasn't enough. But there are certain species that wind up being great winners from storms. There had always been Burmese pythons in the Everglades, maybe going back to the 70s. But that number jumped tremendously after some hurricanes destroyed some captive wildlife facilities and freed Burmese pythons, and maybe enough of them to hit a sort of critical mass and allow Burmese pythons to really take hold in the Everglades.
That brings us to another phenomenon that happens, which is that sometimes, because of storms, animals are picked up and moved by waterspouts, right? Like there could be frogs that don't usually fly that end up flying and moving around in a storm.
Yeah, that does happen. It doesn't happen to the degree to which we sort of as a society would like to dream of it happening. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Magnolia, which ends with this fantastic storm of bullfrogs. But there are cases. I mean, even in 1877, the New York Times reported on 8 alligators about 12 inches long being dumped within 200 yards near the Savannah River. So I think on one hand, you can look and a storm can come and one can feel empathy and pity in the short term for individual animals that could be, you know, suffer some kind of catastrophe and die in mass numbers. But it also, there's this little bit of solace that can be found in the idea that these big storms and these events are things that also distribute animals in some way, allowing species to move beyond their geographic range and, you know, discover new places and evolve into new beautiful things down the road. I guess from a global sort of wildlife perspective, it's a bittersweet occurrence when we have massive weather events.
Well, so let me ask you then finally, with climate change making these storms more frequent and more severe, is that more bitter or more sweet for some of the animals who are going to be affected by them?
Well, I mean, there you get into a very large question. And global climate change, even if it does result in some distribution of species around, life is not able to evolve quickly enough to be commensurate with the destruction that we would see in cases of the Arctic warming, the oceans acidifying, the oceans warming. I personally can't look to species distribution as being a bright spot in a climate change scenario. But, you know, it's almost taboo to say this, but there will be certain species that win from global climate change, that animals that maybe are restricted in their northern movements because of severe winters. And as temperatures change, they'll become big winners. And some part of us might someday look and celebrate those winners. But it's hard to find anything that, like, in a holistic sense seems optimistic or great to look forward to for wildlife in terms of scenarios in which we have more and more severe weather and more changes on our planet.
Well, and as somebody who spends so much time in the outdoors and focusing on wildlife, and when we hear about these things, I think people think, oh, wow, these animals, they're smarter and more interesting than I thought. But do you think that humans have enough of an appreciation for the other species on this planet?
You know, on the whole, as a culture, I would say that we're suffering from some dissociation with the natural world. You know, we're increasingly urbanized. I do worry about what that will mean in the future for the conservation movement, if in fact people do move away from the natural world and become less interested in preserving it. I think that that has implications. But all in all, I find, like, in my social circles or the people I spend a lot of time with, they tend to be infatuated with animals. And that infatuation will oftentimes lead people to think that they're actually smarter than we are, or more capable or more adaptive, you know, and better evolved to cope. But again and again, you're reminded of places and times where animals just make mistakes. And that's an interesting thing to think about with animals, is that they can hit a certain age, certain, you know, different species, like a deer can hit 20 years of age. But they oftentimes make a mistake way before that happens and don't live that long. And I think that it's interesting to start and look at wildlife in that way, as things like individuals who are out there, you know, attempting to cope with a constantly changing environment and constantly evolving threats.
Well, I have to say, I've always loved animals, but as soon as I got a dog, I see all animals in a new way now, because I understand just what you're saying, that they are individuals that are just living in this world in the same way that we are.
Yes.
That is Steve Rinella, who is an outdoorsman and host of the Netflix show Meat Eater. Steve, thank you.
Hey, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
And while we are talking animals, the Washington Post reports that British and Australian researchers had success in drawing fish back to dying coral reefs by broadcasting the sounds of healthy reefs using an underwater loudspeaker. They saw twice as many fish flock back to the reef. Here's one of the researchers, Timothy Gordon.
Climate change and warming seas have caused more damage to coral reefs worldwide in the last 4 years than they have in the whole of recorded history before that. At the start of my PhD, I listened to reefs. I compared how they sounded 5 years ago, before that damage, to how they sound today. And it was the saddest thing I've ever heard. The great animal orchestra of the reef has been replaced by the sounds of silence.
So Gordon and his team say if they can scale up the experiment of broadcasting the sound of healthy reefs, they could bring life back to reefs that have been devastated by rising sea temperatures.
If the cement industry were a country, it would be the third largest carbon dioxide emitter in the world, behind only China and the U.S. You may have heard this statistic, and it's because the process used to mix cement, mixing sand, gravel, a cement binder, and water, not only gives off CO2 as a byproduct, it requires a tremendous amount of heat that normally comes from fossil fuels. But don't boycott your sidewalk yet, because there is some good news. Heliogen is a solar power company that's developed a new technology that could make industrial manufacturing renewable by using the power of the sun. Bill Gross is CEO and founder of Heliogen. He joins us now. And Bill, just take us through this, because we know you brought some investors, big investors, including Bill Gates and the owner of the LA Times, out to Lancaster, California. We've got something set up there. What did you want to show them?
Well, we built a solar concentration field. We're essentially making an oven, a huge oven. We set it at 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which is basically one-third the temperature of the surface of the sun. And we're making this oven almost like a one-acre magnifying glass. It's a field of mirrors that are all perfectly computer-controlled to reflect the sunlight to a single spot. Well, we can make these high temperatures and now use the sun to power these industrial processes, like making cement, making steel, making glass. All of these things previously used a huge amount of fossil fuels, and it wasn't solvable with renewable energy previously, because electricity from solar panels can't provide this kind of heat.
Yeah.
So we're really excited to try and reduce emissions and make these industrial processes possible with renewable for the first time.
So what these cameras in combination with these panels, these mirrors did, was create what you're calling a death ray, where you can just focus it right on something you might need to hit, like a cement mixer, I'm imagining.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, the analogy would be this. Imagine you went into a football stadium and you were sitting with a mirror at one end and you want to reflect the light to someone at the other end. But now imagine all 50,000 people each have a mirror and they're all reflecting it to one spot. Well, you need a lot of coordination and computer control to get that to happen perfectly. And that's the technology we developed, computer vision software that could take all of these things and move them very precisely and accurately. And you said we went out to Lancaster just a few weeks ago. We've been building this all year long. We fired it up. And the very first time we achieved these high temperatures, these record temperatures. And that's why we're so excited.
What about a cement company that's not in sunny Lancaster, California?
Very good question. Right now, we are going after all the types of factories that have either land adjacent to them that's sunny and can integrate with our process. That probably is about half of all of the industrial opportunities. So it's still a $1 trillion opportunity. Over time, we plan to come up with storage methods and other transportation methods so we can move the material maybe to the desert where the sun is great and then move the results back to where the people need it. But for right now, we're focused exactly on what you said, places that have the sunny land adjacent, and that's still an enormous opportunity. Still more than 20% of global emissions happen from that, and we're going to target that first.
Well, you know, it is amazing how much CO2 comes from cement and how much cement is needed. I mean, we just can't, right now anyway, live without creating cement.
Well, to house the 7.5 billion people on Earth and to build the roads, buildings, transportation, everything for them, the two biggest ingredients in our life are cement and steel. And both of those release a huge amount of CO2 because of the burning of the fossil fuels to make them. And we're enjoying the fruits of the benefit of those great materials, but at a huge cost to the planet.
One wonders what Joseph Aspidin of Leeds in England would think. This is the early 19th century bricklayer who came up with this process. And now, you know, cement is just the most desired building material around the world and, as you said, causing this problem. You've said that the applications for Heliogen's technology will be industrial, mixing cement, also steel. But down the line, this kind of concentrated solar power that you've described could be used to make hydrogen fuel. People are now only dreaming about that. Why would that be such a big deal?
Oh, that is a huge deal. So right now, we use hydrogen in almost all of our fuel to date. All of our gasoline has hydrogen. Hydrogen is the single best fuel there is. The problem with it is it's clean when you burn it, but it's dirty when you make it. Right now, all of our hydrogen is made by burning and splitting methane to get the hydrogen. If we could make completely green hydrogen, that would be revolutionary. Well, how could you make completely green hydrogen? Well, you could split water. If you could split water, water is a molecule of two hydrogens and an oxygen, but those are bound together very, very tightly. It takes a huge amount of energy to split them. Well, how would you split them? Well, you could burn fossil fuels to split them, but then that would defeat the purpose. But if you could split water with the sun, that is the holy grail. Mm. Well, it takes 1450 degrees centigrade to split water, and we have already achieved more than that temperature. So our goal long-term is to use solar energy to split the water molecule, make fully green hydrogen, and that could really have an impact on reducing fossil fuel use and, of course, reducing CO2 emissions.
That's Bill Gross, founder and CEO of Heliogen, the solar power company that he says could soon use the power of the sun to make cement and steel, driving down that huge source of carbon emissions. Also, we should say he's the founder of Idea Lab, the LA-based incubator. If you've got an idea, get it to him. Bill Gross, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now. Brett Kavanaugh has been on the Supreme Court for a little more than a year. Getting there was no easy feat.
This whole two-week effort has been a calculated and orchestrated political hit.
Ruth Marcus of The Washington Post has a new book about Kavanaugh's confirmation. She'll join us next time on Here and Now.